Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Of course, this is Adam Lowther. I mean, there's not a week that I'm not Adam Lowther. I am Adam Lowther every single week, but I am doing the podcast this week. I won't be here the following week. Jim will be Jim Petrosky, who is here this
host.
Week.
I'm going to be Adam Lowther next week. So yeah, I got to get a new hat, grow a beard, grow my hair long. I got a whole week to do that.
You do. So, and then of course, Curtis McGiffin is with us this week. So it's good to have Curtis. He's, wearing his NIDS hat as always. And Jim, you're the one guy who forgot to wear your hat this week. So,
see the back. I've got my Army retired hat right back there. And looks like we lost Curtis.
Well, he'll be back.
He'll be back. Yeah, let's get going.
So, you know, there was an article that we decided to talk about this week. It's a foreign affairs article. We oftentimes we'll talk about a foreign affairs piece, and it was called Nuclear Powers, Conventional Wars, The Dangerous Erosion of Deterrence by Carter Malkasian and Zachary Constantino. And, you know, this article was, I think it was one, and I think, you know, I'm going to turn it over to Curtis because this is, you know, a Curtis selection. And if I recall the initial conversation, this one you told me whenever you mentioned it and said, hey, let's talk about this, you thought that the authors were making some fundamental mistakes. So, Curtis, why don't you sort of walk us through the article and give us your take on it?
Well, thanks, Adam. And Jim, good to see you all. I know I was out for the last couple week sessions. So thanks for holding down the fort. No, I particularly like this article for a number of different reasons. And, one of the things that's interesting here, at least from the author's perspective, is sort of this lamenting that nuclear weapons are in such a manner that they are, anytime that there's conflict between great powers that have nuclear weapons, that the potential to escalate is just so big and so bad that we've got a lot to worry about. And I just think that the premise of the piece is sort of on its head. Written in the piece are a number of reasons why, in that sense. But the reality here is that the escalation control that goes on when you have these nuclear powers engaged in lower level conventional conflict is exactly why you have these nuclear weapons. And I'll go right to a quote that they use from Robert Jervis in his great book in 1984, The Illogic of American Nuclear Strategy. And it said, irrational as it may be, the chance of devastation has made our war unusually safe. And his point here is that there is a fear that's embedded in the potential conflict when you have two nuclear powers, that escalation could get out of control. And it is that fear of that uncontrollability that actually helps tampen down these conventional conflicts and keep them as small as possible. And you can also, I mean, not mentioned in the article is you can go to the crystal ball effect, sort of explained by Dr. Kenneth Waltz, who talks about this idea that leaders of countries can envision the atomic mushroom clouds and that they can envision the devastation and whether or not they could survive that in comparison to conventional weapons that are much smaller and whether or not and the possibility that you could survive that. And so I think sort of the idea of this article is to say that deterrence isn't working. Look at all of the conflict going on. Is really, I think, the wrong way to look at this idea, and that a better way to look at this is that deterrence is working because it's keeping conflict at the lowest level. Deterrence doesn't prevent war. Deterrence doesn't doesn't address the causes of war or conflict writ large, or how you want to describe it. All deterrence does is try to convince you that war with me is not worth it. And so what we have to we have to understand that, so that we don't conflate deterrence with war prevention in the sense of eliminating the potential for conflict. What it tries to do is try to keep conflict, disagreements, from becoming big problems.
So, you know, all analogies are wrong, but some are useful. So let me try to reason by analogy, and hopefully it's useful, even if
Adam,
it might be either.
As long as it's not a sports analogy, because I won't get it. Okay, just let me know.
So it's, you know, the argument is, well, nukes don't prevent all war, so therefore let's get rid of nuclear weapons.
Right.
It's kind of like arguing, well, police don't prevent all crimes, so therefore, and, you know, nuclear weapons can destroy the world.
Well, and you got to finish the thought.
Prevent all crimes. And, oh, by the way, they you know, every year they, you know, they shoot a certain number of, you know, innocent or unarmed people. So therefore, it's not worth having police, and we should just, if they're not going to prevent war or all crime, and they're going to sometimes shoot innocent people, then we should have no police ever. It's a similar analogy, mm-hmm. but the point is that police are, they were never intended to prevent. I mean, you know, in law enforcement, they have no legal obligation to prevent any crime. They respond to crime once it's happened.
Right.
And so, you know, the idea that let's defund the police and get rid of them because they don't stop all crime, it's a ridiculous notion. We do know that they offer a substantive good, and that good is, you know, reducing crime, just like nuclear weapons have eliminated great power wars. They have reduced the number of people that die in conflict. I mean, we have hard numbers, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and it isn't because the better angels of our nature, you know, after 1945, you know, there's a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, in which they argue that it's not nuclear weapons. It's really that just people are more pacific, and that we have global institutions mm-hmm. that have, you know, stopped war. And somehow all of these things just happened magically after 1945.
Right.
And magically the institutions got better, and people were become more peaceful, and
we're more enlightened now, Adam.
And more enlightened only after 1945.
Right.
Instantly. Which is just you know, absurd. But at any rate, I was trying to offer a useful analogy for your discussion, but, you know, maybe it was useful, maybe not. So go ahead.
Thanks.
Continue.
Thanks,
please.
Adam. Oh, wait a minute. I want to get to chime in here a little bit. You know, Curtis stole a little bit of my thunder here. So first of all, he said, you know, you could stop people from, you know, nuclear weapons are valuable in stopping great power wars because, you know, you can, I think he said ostensibly, or maybe he used a smaller word because I know Curtis. But anyway, he used a different word saying that they can see the results of a nuclear weapon. But I just want to remind our audience, you can go to the web. The Department of Energy has submitted many, many films of these weapons being detonated.
That's right.
So if someone is considering starting a nuclear war, go look at those videos first. There's a lot of very good ones for you to consider not engaging in as you start that war. So that's the first piece. The second piece I thought was really interesting with this article is it continues to go back and pointing at the wrong spot. And although I 100% agree with Adam the way he presented this, I would say that this is another case of what if, like, the whole history, we have a whole history to look back on and say the Cold War happened. Oh, it was terrible. We shouldn't have another Cold War. Well, honestly speaking, the Cold War, we didn't have any nuclear wars, and that was a good thing, right?
So, or great power wars. Right. No World War III either.
None. And that's the point. People go back and look at that negatively, and I look at it as positively. And then the third piece here is that I think is the sort of the red flare to me. When I read this article, I said, this article is great. it's talking about removing conventional weapons and building more nuclear weapons, because all the instances it gives are about conventional conflicts, not nuclear conflicts. We just got rid of all the conventional conflicts, and then we would repeat all the nuclear conflicts we've had since there have been two or more nuclear leaders. Let's see. Every conventional conflict we've had since 1945, put that one stack. And in every nuclear conflict we've had since 1945, put that in the other stack. Which would you rather have? you know, I'd rather have the latter. We need more nuclear weapons and fewer conventional weapons. I mean, they're less costly. We've gone through this many times on here. Right. They're less costly, easier to control, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I saw that in this article that I thought was sort of overlooked because of the focus on what if tomorrow there's a nuclear war. We didn't prevent that one. Well, what if there isn't a tomorrow? Well, how do we prevent that? You know what I'm saying? It's just, it's, you can what if this thing all to death, but it's not happening. I mean, I don't remember where are we on this doomsday clock due to the nuclear war that was going to happen right. between Pakistan and India a couple months ago. They said the nuclear or the doomsday clock was down to a couple seconds. I think we survived. I don't know.
I think aren't we like 6 minutes past midnight right now?
It's the next day.
I think it's the next day.
It's all those what ifs, and we've got to get out of the what if scenario as a world.
So, you know, one of the things that this article sort of hints at but doesn't actually call out is really what it's describing is this sort of this idea, this instability stability paradox. Mm-hmm. And it sort of posits that, you know, nations who have nuclear weapons sort of in their arsenal, the casting shade over them, sort of allows them or frees them up to do certain things at certain levels because they sort of feel like they're empowered to do it, right? And it's most commonly used in the India-Pakistan question, and the authors, you know, dutifully go through the number of conflicts, even to the recent one that we talked about in a podcast in June of 2025 about the Pakistan-India skirmish. And yes, the history is filled with these ideas of, you know, we had China and the Soviet Union fought a border skirmish in 1969. I think there was about 125 people killed in that, you know, on both across the both sides, you know, and of course, India and Pakistan, as far as, you know, nuclear powers facing each other. I think part of what the authors are concerned about or arguing for is the idea that there are now non-nuclear powers attacking nuclear powers. And because of this, they're arguing that deterrence does not work because of these issues. They go all the way back to the Falkland Islands in 1982, where Argentina, you know, attacks, you know, a nuclear armed United Kingdom, and this progresses. They talk about, well, even goes back farther than that. They talk about China and Vietnam, mm-hmm. In 1979. I mean, you could name a bunch of them. They never mentioned Iraq and the United States in 1991 and 2003, and America and Vietnam and so forth and so on. I just really think it's a red herring to argue that that nations who have nuclear weapons are somehow impervious to any form of conflict. That just simply isn't true, because your superpowers who have nuclear weapons, and Adam, you can add to this if you're agreeing with me, but what you generally have is they have interventionist policies, or at least interventionist attitudes, and because they feel empowered, right, in that stability instability paradox, and so they feel that they can go and do things regardless, and it's all sides of this. And that's why, you know, your core five nuclear powers are all former colonial powers, superpowers from victors from the end of World War II, so to speak. The one exception is China, which is a superpower, but sort of came along after it became a communist state.
Well, what about the idea? And this sort of goes to the point you're making, and that is that, you know, there's I'm drawing a blank. He was on the faculty up at National War College. and he wrote a great book about why America loses wars. And the simple fact is that small nations purposefully choose to fight the United States over and over and over again. And they are quite literally never worried that we're going to nuke them.
It's the mouse that roared. There's no credible threat against them nuclear-wise.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess it's just the United States. I mean, look at Ukraine right now. Ukraine right now is not worried that Russia will nuke them. They do not fundamentally
based
believe
on
it.
The behavior of this drone attack on the Russian strategic forces a month or two ago. I completely agree. They weren't afraid of what Putin doesn't have for some reason is not put forth enough credibility.
And this is part of what I find the flaw in a lot of the argument. It goes back to, is deterrence theory truly based on rational choice theory?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in rational choice theory, I mean, if I were to like dumb it down and make it sort of really, really simple, it has 3 points. You know, you have choices, right? So you have preferences, right? So for me, the three greatest, you know, singers / bands of all times are very clearly Taylor Swift, One Direction, and NSYNC. I mean, I'm going to tear up.
NSYNC?
When Taylor Swift, when she says, haters going to hate, that speaks to me, makes me cry. And then, of course, One Direction, when they sing that song, Girl, Don't You Know You're Beautiful? I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, I got a wife because of that song. And then NSYNC, if you've seen their sweet moves on the stage at an NSYNC concert, you'll know that they're the greatest dancers. And I've thrown some of those sweet moves down at the club a few times. And so, you know, very clearly, they're the three greatest musical performers of all times. And then, so I got preferences. Then I rate my preferences, right? And so, of course, you know, I'm going to say because of her sweet, sweet lyrics, Taylor Swift is number one, NSYNC is number two, because who doesn't love dancing? And One Direction is number three. So I have preferences, I rank my preferences, and then third, I execute based on my preferences. So when Taylor Swift, One Direction, and NSYNC all come to Kansas City on the same night and I can only go to one, obviously I'm going to drop the $4,000 to go to the Chiefs Stadium and watch Taylor Swift. I mean, me and 70,000 screaming 14-year-old girls are out there just loving Taylor Swift. And while all the dads, those fools who didn't buy a ticket, are standing out in the parking lot waiting on their daughters, I'm the guy that gets to watch her live. That's rational choice theory. Have preferences, rank those preferences, execute based on preferences, therefore you're rational. That's what deterrence is based on. Now, there's this other thing called prospect theory,
mm-hmm.
and prospect theory says that we're fundamentally irrational, that we overvalue losses, we undervalue gains, and because of that, we are more fundamentally risk-averse when we should be risk-acceptant. So when the probability of success is really high, we still say, well, but there's a 10% chance it could go wrong, and therefore I don't want to take the, even though I've got a 90% chance of success, I'm not going to take the chance because I could still lose. And what that means, and then of course what that says is that when you're forced, when you're given a loss, you're forcibly taking a loss, then you become highly risk acceptant because your rationale becomes, you know, well, why not gamble everything if I'm guaranteed a loss?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the risk aversion is the stock market, where you say, yep. I'm going to hold that stock and it'll come back one day, so I'm going to keep it. Because if I sell it now, I'll lose money. So mm-hmm. I'll hold it and it'll come back, you know, next week, next month, next year. And then the other thing is the other one where you become highly risk acceptant, that's gambling. Well, I've lost $5,000. What do? Well, I double my bet so I can win the money back. I gamble more. And that's prospect theory. So rational choice versus prospect theory. And what these guys write to me looks very much like rational choice theory.
Mm.
And traditional deterrence theory, general deterrence, Cold War general deterrence theory is a rational choice option. Whereas I actually think prospect theory describes why deterrence really works, mm-hmm. because people are fundamentally irrational and they overvalue potential losses. And then when they're guaranteed a loss, they become risk acceptant. So if you're Slobodan Milosevic, or if you're Saddam Hussein, why do you, when the U.S. says, you know, if you don't, then we will, why do they choose to fight the U.S.? It's because the U.S. has guaranteed them a loss. They've put them in a position where they say, why not gamble everything? And then why does deterrence hold for, you know, 80 years now? Why is it held? Because world leaders have said, man, I might could win, but man, if I lose, that's a big loss. And so I don't know that the argument they're making really is accurate from the perspective of how does human psychology actually work and how does leader psychology work. I know that was a bit of a long tangent.
No, that was excellent. That was a great way to lay this out for our audience. I think they ought to read the article and then tie that together. Aside from your taste in music here, Adam, I'd say, you know, it's pretty good.
I think you left out, the makeup side of this and including Kiss in your list.
I just was glad Adam finally revealed how he hurt his back. So you've been busting some moves, huh?
If you don't have an Xbox and a Xbox that where you can do the dancing games, you don't know what you're missing. There so you need to get one.
I think you'll learn a lot. I think it's the punch in the face you got from Taylor Swift's boyfriend there on the Chiefs. I love the description. Prospect theory is one of those things that, to your point, of what may the rational choice theory being part of Cold War, I think today what we see much more of is prospect theory in operation. This idea that I fundamentally will take more risk to prevent loss than I will to gain. And a lot of it comes to how do you measure that out? And so what deterrence today really, really plays on the calculus that that I don't want to lose anything. And so the one exception might be, and it depends on the perspective, is Ukraine. And I think it's because Putin feels that the loss of Ukraine is too great. It isn't that he's trying to gain it. It is that he is trying not to lose it. And so when you think in that perspective, then prospect theory is really playing in here. I think it goes the other way, too. When you look at the artificial islands in the South China Sea built by China, what you see now is they've built these islands. They've made the investments. They have more or less annexed this area of the South China Sea. And the world has let them do that. Mm-hmm. And so now it has become status quo. And so prospect theory now tells us that if you want to change, or if you want to reverse that status, you better be ready for war. Because China now believes they will fight not to lose it. They've already gained it. So prospect theory tells me that this is now a much more difficult fight if you want to try to reverse that.
Yeah, if you reverse it, then that is a guaranteed loss for China. Mm-hmm.
Correct. So prospect theory tells me they will fight.
Yeah, because they're going to double down.
Right.
Whereas, on the same token, you know, we're risk averse in saying, should we force China to abide by international law? And we see that the risk of doing that is too great.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, this is the problem with a lot of folks is that when they apply, you know, general deterrence, because general deterrence during the Cold War, basically, it said, I don't need to understand your language. I don't need to understand your culture, your history. I don't need to know any of that. I've got 30,000 nuclear weapons. You've got 30,000 nuclear weapons. We both know what happens when you use them. And therefore, you're not crazy and I'm not crazy. And therefore, we'll never use them. That was basic Cold War. That was general deterrence logic.
Balance of power.
And I don't need to know anything about you. Whereas prospect theory sort of, it's more nuanced. Mm-hmm. And you actually have to, because I've thought, you know, in thinking about why do weaker conventional powers choose to always fight the U.S.? Because they always choose to fight us. Mm-hmm. Why do they do it? And it's because we put them in a position where they're guaranteed a loss. And so therefore they say, well, nothing I'm going to lose my country anyways. Why not double down? And so I don't think that their explanation of how nuclear weapons play in a lot of these scenarios is particularly applicable to why the leaders of those countries, right? Why do those leaders make the decisions that they do? And but that's just my take, Curtis.
Well, I think that's a fascinating take, and I don't necessarily disagree with any of that. I think it's what I think though is from as a strategist, you take what you just described, and it goes to the point of why you must make your deterrent more robust, because you must convince them that you are too hard to take. And this is why Iran was seeking nuclear weapons, right? When you've watched the great Satan regime change the countries on either side of your border, there's a lot of risk to them.
Yeah, I mean, put yourself in Iran. So, you bring up Iran. It's a great example. So if you're the Iranians and it's 2001, you've been an enemy since 1979, and now the Americans are on your northern border in Afghanistan. And then by 2003, they're on your western border.
Right.
And oh, by the way, the American president said there are three bad guys in the world.
Right.
And you're one of them. So, I mean, you're the Iranians, and what you know is that having nuclear weapons is the one way the Americans won't attack you. That's what they learned from the North Koreans, because they had them by 2006. So the Iranians are like, wait a second. They've said we're the bad guy. They've already toppled the regimes in the two countries next to us. The one country they won't touch has nukes. I wonder what we should do. It's kind of a no-brainer.
Right. Well, and then you add to that mix 2011 Libya, right? Gaddafi gives up his nukes. He complies. He tries to get back into the good graces.
And what do we do?
And then he is ousted by the same Western forces. And guess who watched that happen?
Yeah.
North Korea, right? Kim Jong-un. And so the motivation for them to give up their nukes has gotten even harder. So these are this is why this is not an easy thing to do, right? This deterrence thing and these the politics and strategy that goes with nuclear weapons, much more challenging than maybe even just obtaining them. As Jim knows, I mean, the physics is the physics.
Yeah,
but how you apply them is completely a human factor, and that is just way too complex to predict.
But it also shows some of the stability added by the nuclear weapons as well. I'm looking up on my shelf for those looking. I'm looking at the Sagan Waltz articles, you know, where you have one advocate for everyone having nuclear weapons because it provides stability, and the other one saying, get rid of all of them because, you know, then if no one has them, there'll be no more conflict. Well, I don't know. When you look at what's happening, you see what happens. And to the point of the paper, the other thing I think that has sort of gotten a little odd, at the end of the paper talks about, well, now that we have all these skirmishes, we have nuclear states involved in this, we need to increase this and you know, we need more diplomacy, we need more of this, we need rapid escalation. We'd need them whether we had nuclear weapons or not if there's an increase in conventional warfare. So this has nothing to do with nuclear weapons, which I just don't understand in a paper.
Well, it's a blatant statement of the obvious, right? Like we've been trying to do that for 80 plus years, right? We need more diplomacy, we need this and that. Look we tried this, right? Adam reminded us that we are much more enlightened now than we were prior to 1945. But in 1928, we had the Kellogg-Briand Act, where 62 nations signed this treaty that basically outlawed war as a means to solve interstate conflict and disagreements. Guess who were the main signatories? Who were three of the signatories? Germany, Japan, and Italy. And what were they doing 10 years later? Their national interests changed, whatever it was. But the bottom line is, well, and their leadership changed, but in some cases. But the bottom line is that enlightenment does not necessarily solve conflict. What enlightenment can do is help you to find alternative ways to deal with conflict. But in the end, conflict will always occur. And if you eliminate nuclear weapons, all you're going to do, Adam, is make conventional war great again.
You will. But that, yep. You know, the great thing about conventional war is that if you look, I was looking at global population growth, and it's been growing exponentially since 1945. It literally takes off. Mm-hmm. And it takes off because wars have been ended.
Correct.
And because of global population, we've had this thing called global warming. So if we really want to get a hold of global warming, if we start killing 100 million people a year, then what we'll do, that means people won't have babies. It means the global population will start to come back down. Global warming will decline, and then people can be happy. But well, we just have to, we got to kill a bunch of people to make that happen.
Well, let's not forget nuclear winter, right?
Well, and that'll solve the global,
cool the earth down, right?
Yeah.
We're just being sarcastic, audience.
Oh, I thought you guys were serious.
We are not advocating for any of that.
I was already starting to write the letter to you guys that you won't be on next week for other reasons.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I would just say that the thing about conventional war is every leader believes on day one they can win.
Yeah.
But in a nuclear war, everybody on day one believes they can't win. And we have to remember that is the rational calculus. And that calculus must never be questioned. And so you must do very robust, proactive means to ensure that it can never be questioned. And so then you have it, right? All through the Cold War, we feared that nuclear weapons would be the cause of World War III. But ironically, it prevented it.
Yeah. And here we are.
And here we are.
Living in a period of unprecedented prosperity.
Unprecedented. And what John Gaddis calls the long peace. And we're still enjoying it.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe nuclear weapons are more relevant than people want to give them credit for being.
Yeah. And sadly, the average citizen doesn't see it that way. And I hope that every one of our listeners takes this podcast out and finds three of their friends, sits down, has a adult beverage or other drink with them, and listens to this podcast. Pass it on, folks. This is real.
That's right. So, Adam, we're coming up on the 80th anniversary of nuclear deterrence.
Yeah.
August 6th is right around the corner. Of course, that marks the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki on August 9th. And so I think, you know, again, devastating issues. But what was born from that, the nuclear era that came from that day, has really seen, I think, an unprecedented peace. 5 to 7 great power wars per century. We've now gone 80 years without one. Yeah. We had, since 1945, Adam or Jim, you're the nuke guy. How many
you
people?
You were there.
Oh, you were there. Yeah. How many people have nuclear weapons killed since 1945? In anger.
Count them all up.
In anger.
None.
Zero.
It took me a while to add that
zero.
Up.
Zero. Adam, how many people have died since 1945 in conventional wars?
Millions.
23 million by the last count that I can catch.
23 million. 23 million. I didn't know the exact million. Number. Yeah.
That's the closest thing. And so, and that's post-colonialism. That's, the proxy wars of the Cold War. That is global war on terror and all everything in between.
That's 1/4 of World War II's conflict-related
absolutely.
Deaths.
Absolutely. And what, arguably...
80 years. 80 years.
Over 80 years. So we're talking about, with a population in the aggregate that has grown exponentially.
It's grown. We're three times larger.
Right. So this is a good news story, America. And so, this is the beauty of deterrence and what it has come to it. And thank goodness, for the scientists who discovered this technology and capability. Thank goodness to the strategy and politicians and policymakers who are able to thoughtfully and rationally employ the methodology, the theory, in order to make this approach towards peace work. Again, it doesn't solve all problems. It was never meant to do that. But it solves the big ones if we work hard at it.
I mean, it's been so impactful that it caused global warming.
Oh my gosh! By increasing the population and
by increasing the population gotcha. By 300%.
There you go. There you go.
Yep.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot to be proud there in that sense and thankful for. But I would say that this is an interesting article. I commend our folks to read Nuclear Powers and Conventional War. It's Nuclear Power, Conventional Wars, The Dangerous Erosion of Deterrence. By Carter Malkasian and Zachary Constantino. Check it out on Foreign Affairs and see what you think. Send us an email. Let us know if we got it right or not.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim. Thanks, Curtis. It's been a great discussion, as always. Thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. You know, as always, read Global Security Review. Join 150,000 other people. And you know, read its articles and, you know, potentially write your own. You know, I'm always here to you know, accept good article submissions, and you very well may get your article published. So do that. And, of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.